There once was a wicked man named Haman, and he hated the Jews. He was their enemy. This Haman was a leader in the kingdom of Persia in the 5th century before Christ, and he was very proud, narcissistic even. To him, everything was about him. And there was a particular Jew named Mordecai who refused to honor Haman the way he felt that he was due. And Haman could not let it go. He decided that Mordecai must die. And not just Mordecai, but his whole family. And not just his whole family, but his whole ethnic people group, the Jews, the Old Testament people of God. And not just the Jews in the citadel of Susa where Haman and Mordecai lived, but all the Jews throughout the kingdom, throughout the whole wide world. And if anybody could do it, it was Haman. Haman concocted a plan that started by manipulating the king, Xerxes by name, also known as Ahasuerus, to authorize the complete and total extermination of the Jews in one day. What day? They picked the day by lot. They rolled some dice. In Persian words, they cast the pur, a little ceramic piece you rolled like dice to pick something at random, or by luck, or by fate, whatever you might believe in. And they cast the pur on some kind of a calendar. And it landed on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, some 11 months in the future. On that day, all of the Jews were scheduled to die by the king's own decree, which could not be revoked. But is that what happened? We shall see. Because today's the day. Today's the day that we read what actually happened on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, how it all turned out. Because there was a chance that Haman's wicked plot would be foiled. Pretty small chance. An unlikely chance, but a real one. Who knows? It turns out that Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah who had, it turns out, somehow become the queen of Persia. Yes, a Jewish queen of Persia. Unlikely, I know. It was a secret, though, that she was a Jew. It was a secret that she was related to Mordecai. It was a secret even from her husband, the king. The king did not know that he had decreed his wife's death. But that's how it had turned out. And Mordecai persuaded Hadassah, also known as Esther, to beg the king to save their people. And she did. It took all of the courage that she could muster, but Esther overcame every fear and approached the king, even though she could have died. And she used every one of her powers of persuasion to plead with the king to spare her life and the lives of her people. Queen Esther did this through inviting her husband and Haman to two banquets. In Hebrew, mishta, where she laid out a wonderful feast, two wonderful feasts, and then revealed both her true identity and the wicked plot of Haman. And it turns out that she was successful with the king. It turns out that Haman's overpreening pride was his downfall. He had counted his chickens before they hatched. Haman had built a giant killing pole at his home, on which he planned to get the king to impale Mordecai. But it turns out, that night the king couldn't sleep. And he was reminded in his insomnia by his bedtime story that he owed Mordecai one for having once saved his life. So the king hilariously ordered Haman to honor Mordecai. And it was all downhill from there. By the end of that day, it turned out, Haman was impaled on the very pole he had intended for Mordecai. And then they came up with a plan to try to counter Haman's plan. Because even though this vile Haman was dead, his decree lived on. We read last week in chapter 8 that the king allowed Mordecai to write up another decree to counter the first one and send it out with his ring under his name. They couldn't stop the first decree from going into effect. There were still orders from the king to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day, the 13th day of Adar, and to plunder their goods. But now, there was a second decree that was following the first one on fast hoofbeats. It was issued 2 months and 10 days later, and it granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and to protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of any nationality or province that might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. And the day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the provinces of King Xerxes was the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar. It turns out there was a fighting chance that the Jews might survive. And maybe more than just a chance. Because it seems like suddenly everything had turned out in their favor. But now we'll actually find out what actually happened. Chapter 9, verse 1. Are you ready? How did it turn out? 8 months and 20 days later, on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities in all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those seeking their destruction. No one could stand against them because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews because fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. Stop there for just a second. Here's how it turned out. Everything was totally turned around. Did you see that phrase in verse 1? But now the tables were turned. The Christian Standard Bible has just the opposite happened. The English Standard Version says the reverse occurred. The old King James Bible says it was turned to the contrary. In other words, the whole thing flipped over. Look at verse 2 again. On this day, note that, the very day that Haman wanted them all to die, the exact opposite occurred. On this day, the day that the lot had fallen on, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. In other words, everything was flipped right side up. Let me ask you a question. Who did that? Who did that? Well, it doesn't say. It's a passive verb here. It just says it happened. It doesn't say who turned the tables, if anyone. It doesn't give a name. It doesn't seem like we could say that it was the king's doing. I mean, this whole thing started to unravel one night when the king couldn't sleep. He had no control over that. This is not the king's long, wise plan, anything but. And as much as Mordecai was bright and Esther was brave, it doesn't say that they did this either. And yes, all the Jews throughout the world assembled and fought, but it doesn't even say that they fought well. It just says, verse 2, no one could stand against them because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. They're running scared. Who did that? Where did this fear come from? It doesn't say. It does say that the leaders helped the Jews. On the day when they were supposed to kill them by the king's orders, they are defending them and sending them supplies and more troops. Why? Because they were afraid, it says, of Mordecai. Where did that come from? It came from this amazing turn of events. Here's my question. Was somebody turning the events? However it came about, it was good news. They didn't die. They lived and they won. Look at verse 5. The Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. In the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. They also killed Parshandatha, Dalphon, Aspatha, Paratha, Adalia, Aradatha, Parmashata, Arasai, Aradai, and Vizatha, the 10 sons of Haman, son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder. I didn't tell you to drown out his name. Let's do this. Let's wait until the last two times that Haman is mentioned in this book to boo and hiss today. It'll be verses 24 and 25 when we get to those, and we'll do it up big and loud then. The Jews were attacked this day. There were plenty of people who hated them. Plenty of people who followed Haman. And they knew it was their royal right to attack the Jews. And they did. They wanted them dead and they wanted their houses and stuff. Including all ten of Haman's sons. Remember how proud Haman was of them back in chapter 5? How he boasted about how many sons he had. Haman had convinced them all that the Jews were worthy of extermination, and they got up that morning ready to take them out. But it turns out they were the ones who were killed on that day, along with 500 other men just in the city of Susa. Notice that it's only men who are mentioned, not women and children. The second decree said that the Jews could kill women and children, but it didn't say, the Bible never says that they ever did that. It does say that they did not seize the plunder. They were allowed to do that by edict as well, but they didn't do that. How come? Well, it doesn't say, but my best guess is that they were treating the plunder like how the Jews were supposed to treat the plunder under the rules of engagement in the conquest of Canaan. See, for example, Joshua 6 and 7. And they were, in a way, also undoing what King Saul had done wrong with King Agag. Remember we said back in chapter 3 that Haman was somehow related to Agag, and Mordecai was somehow related to Saul. And in 1 Samuel 15, King Saul was supposed to kill Agag because he was an Amalekite bent on destroying Israel, but not to grab the plunder from Agag. But King Saul did the opposite, right? He grabbed the plunder and then left King Agag alive, allowing Agag's wicked line to continue 500 years on, all the way to Haman. Well, on this day, they undid all of that. They put their attackers to death, and they did not seize the plunder. In their self-defense, they exhibited much self-control, which is highly commendable. Verse 11. The number of those slain in the citadel of Susa was reported to the king that same day. Real-time intel from the battlefield. The king said to Queen Esther, "Whew! The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? It will also be granted." Huh. That's something, isn't it? Esther no longer has to beg. The king comes and just asks her what she wants. He's amazed himself, I think, at how successful the Jews were on that day, the 13th day of Adar. And he reports the battlefield intel to his wife. He's like, "Whoa, these Jews were successful today. Not sure I saw that coming." And he says, "So, Esther, what do you want now? You ready for that mink coat? Alexis? A Birkin? What is your request, Queen Esther?" That's the fourth time that he's asked her that question in this book. But her answer is always the same, isn't it? When she's not inviting him to a banquet, what's she saying? Save my people. Save my people, King. Esther probably understands that there are still followers of Haman out there who are going to be bent on revenge tomorrow. 500 may be dead, but there may be up to that many more in this city. I know they aren't supposed to attack tomorrow, but what if they do? So verse 13, she says, if it pleases the king, Esther answered, give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow also. And let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on gallows. So the king commanded that this be done. An edict was issued in Susa, and they hanged the 10 sons of Haman. The Jews in Susa came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they put to death in Susa 300 men. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder. What do you think about Esther's request here? Is she not just brave and beautiful, but bloodthirsty as well? It's possible. She's just human, too. Esther's not perfect. She may have wanted revenge. I think she's just a realist. She understands that they probably need a second day to ward off the attacks, and they need to put these 10 corpses up on the wooden poles, just like their daddies, to be a billboard that this is what happens when you plot to attack the Jews unprovoked. It's justice. Notice again in verse 15 that they did not lay their hands on the plunder. This is just about self-defense. It's not about hate. It's not about getting rich. They're not becoming Haman themselves, even as they win. Ahasuerus was wondering how things were going on outside of Susa. It's his kingdom, after all. And the answer was, pretty well for the Jews. Look at verse 16. Meanwhile, the remainder of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also assembled to protect themselves and get relief from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of them, but did not lay their hands on the plunder. This happened on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. It's over. The worst day ever is over. And it's turned into one of the best days. And so the next day, they turn into a holiday. Verse 17 says they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. Wow, I wonder how that felt. For all those months, for almost a year, this sentence has been laid on them. We're dying on the 13th of Adar. We're all dying on the 13th of Adar. And here on the 14th of Adar, they're not dead. They're alive. The word for feasting there is, can you guess? Mishta. It's our word for banquet. They made it a day for a big party. They celebrated. They rejoiced. They ate. They drank. They danced. They retold the story. They took the day off. Remember how last week they celebrated just anticipation of this day? Like last week they heard that this day was coming and they had a fighting chance and they were so overjoyed. There was, what did it say? There was light and gladness and joy and honor and parties and banquets. And if they were rejoicing like that, just in anticipation of the chance of surviving, how much more would they be celebrating after they actually won? You know, it doesn't say how many Jews actually died. Probably some did. And there were funerals. It's not what the storyteller wants to emphasize. If none had died, then I'll bet they would have told us that. But it's an overwhelming victory. 75,000 people had attacked them that day, and they had beat them back, and they were gone. They'd won. That's totally worthy of a string of unending parties. That's worthy of a day of feasting and joy. In the next section, the storyteller explains how the Jews came to make it an ongoing annual celebration. They didn't just do it once. They did it the next year too, and the year after that. And the storyteller, he or she, also clears up the question of why some celebrated on one day and others on another. The Jews around the kingdom celebrated it on the 14th day. That's the day after their one-day war was over. Verse 18. The Jews in Susa, however, had assembled on the 13th and 14th. And then on the 15th, they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. Does that make sense to you? Verse 19, that is why rural Jews, those living in villages, observe the 14th of the month of Adar as a day of joy and feasting, a day of giving presents to each other. Feasting and joy. Joy and feasting. And giving presents to each other. Sounds a lot like Christmas to me. This explains why the Jews in Susa celebrated on the 15th. It's because they had a two-day war. And the 15th was the day after that. In verse 20, Mordecai decides to tell all of the Jews to make this an annual holiday, a new holiday for the Jews, not one that God had laid out in the Torah, but one that just popped up because of this great victory. Verse 20, Mordecai recorded these events, maybe he even wrote the book of Esther, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, I think depending on where you live, as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. What a wonderful thing to do. They took this day to celebrate the amazing thing that had happened to them. And not just to rejoice, but to love others. They had been shown much grace, so they gifted one another and they gave to those who could not give back, the poor. I got our message title from verse 23 there, Days of Feasting and Joy. What were they celebrating on those days? I was thinking about how to apply this part of the story to our lives today, and I was thinking about this pop-up holiday that they were creating and what exactly was so great about it that it was worth celebrating every single year. It clearly is, but what about it? Well, I came up with four things, and they are four things that you and I can celebrate on the regular as well. Even more so because we live on this side of Jesus' first advent. And conveniently, they all start with an R. So the first one, if you're taking notes, is reversal. These days of feasting and joy were days to celebrate this great reversal when, verse 22, their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning turned into a day of celebration. The tables were turned. The opposite occurred. It was turned to the contrary. Everything was turned not upside down, but right side up. Who did that? I think we have a pretty good idea, don't we? We know that our God is in the business of reversing things. Our God takes the worst things ever and works them to our good. Our God takes, like that song that the Verists pointed out this morning, the I heard the bells on Christmas Day. Everything is so bad, so bleak and wrong. And yet, there's the bells. God's doing something. It's going to change. God takes something like the death of Jesus on the cross. You know, that's the worst thing that ever happened, right? That was the greatest injustice ever committed. And he gives us salvation through it. He reversed even Jesus' death. Not just the effects of Jesus' death, but he brought Jesus back to life. Talk about reversals. Or as we sang this morning, verse 3 of Joy to the World, he comes to make his blessings flow far as the curse is found. Where do we find the curse? Everywhere you turn, right? You can see the shadow of the curse. It makes it into our broken DNA. When Jesus returns, he's going to reverse the curse. And so wherever the curse is found, his blessings will flow. Do you believe that? Have you seen his reversing power at work in your life already? Our God is in the 180 business. And wherever he turns everything right side up, it's worthy of celebrating. What has he turned right side up for you? His reversals are worth feasting, mishta, and joy. Number two is relief. Did you hear that word? That R word in verses 16 and verse 22? The time when the Jews got relief from their enemies? Who did that? Mordecai had predicted back in chapter 4 that Israel would get relief and deliverance from, he said, from another place if Esther was going to chicken out. And we said that's the closest Mordecai gets to naming the Lord in this book. We know where this relief came from. It's obvious by now. The Jews were saved from their enemies by their Lord. And how much more have you and I been saved from ours? Our enemies are not flesh and blood. They're not the children of Haman or Agag. Our enemies are sin and Satan. And we've been rescued from them. Decisively, even though we still feel their ongoing effects, the war has been won by our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen? Even the last enemy of death has been defeated. We have every reason to feast and rejoice. And the third one is rest. Their relief was not just victory, but rest on the other side of it. I think it's really interesting that the holiday they set up was not the 13th day of the 12th month. It's not Adar 13th. You might expect that. In fact, I did. In fact, I thought it was until I studied it this week. But it's the 14th day of Adar. That's when they celebrated. They did not set up the day of battle as their holiday. They chose the day after the battle was over, the day they had rest, the day they could relax again, the day they had peace. And of course, we celebrate the fact that Jesus is our rest and Jesus is our peace, the Prince of Peace. How much more do we have reason for days of feasting and joy, for giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor? Keith pointed out this morning, I love how generous our church gets around Christmas time. You're always generous year round. But I think there's something about reflecting on the greatest gift that's ever been given, the greatest reversal, the greatest relief, the greatest rest that makes someone want to give to others that they love. And give to those who need love the most, the poor. Come with us next Sunday afternoon when we go around and we go to shut-ins and others and we sing to them these wonderful things and we give them little gifts of Christmas cookies. Christmas cookies and fudge and Buckeyes, which I don't share. We have our free fridge out there. It just got stocked again yesterday. And the food bank. And the gifts out there under the table. We don't do that because we're so great or to impress anybody like Xerxes probably did with his generosity. No, we do it because we've been given the greatest gift of all. Amen? Reversal, relief, rest. In verse 23, the Jews received this universal letter from Mordecai and they agreed to establish this holiday. The next section lays out what the holiday is all about. And here are the last two times that the bad guy's name is written in the Bible. So let's get really loud with boos and hisses and foot stomping when I read his name. Verse 23. So the Jews agreed to continue the celebration they had begun, doing what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast the pur, that is the lot, for their ruin and destruction. But when the plot came to the king's attention at Esther's second banquet, he issued written orders that the evil scheme Haman had devised against the Jews should come back onto his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Well done. There's that reversal again, right? Haman is now gone, never to be mentioned again without shame. And they came up with a name for this new holiday. Up till now, it didn't have a name. Now they give it a name, verse 26. Therefore, these days were called Purim or Purim, from the word pur. Because of everything written in this letter and because of what they had seen and what had happened to them, the Jews took it upon themselves to establish the custom that they and their descendants and all who joined them should without fail observe these 2 days every year in the way prescribed and at the time appointed. These days should be remembered and observed in every generation by every family and in every province and in every city. And these days of Purim should never cease to be celebrated by the Jews, nor should the memory of them die out among their descendants. And they haven't. The Jews still observe Purim all over the world. It'll be March 2nd and 3rd in 2026. The Jews around the world will celebrate it on Adar 14, and the Jews specifically who live in what were walled cities such as Jerusalem and Hebron will celebrate it on Adar 15. And on those days, they'll raise the roof. They will party, they will feast. They have so much raucous fun on Purim. They'll put on a play, they'll boo and hiss and stomp and have these things called graggers, which are noisemakers to drown out the name of the enemy of the Jews. And they cheer for the name of Mordecai. And the girls dress up like brave Esther, and there's food and drinks and music, days of feasting and joy. Because they know that their story was a comedy. In the literary sense, that is, that it had a happy ending. There was a great reversal, a great relief, and a great rest. And how much more should we raise the roof because we know the rest of the story? Because we knew that Jesus came and is coming again to turn our story into a comedy forever. My last word is reign. R-E-I-G-N, reign. That was the closest R word I could get to mean providence. The Jews named their holiday Purim, which is the plural for pur, right? That Persian word that means something like the die or the lot. So it's plural. It's both of them. It's all of them. Now, I would have gone with something like Big Lots, but that was apparently taken. Lots of Lots? Odd Lots? Probably not. Yeah. I think it's fascinating that they named their holiday after a game of chance. Right? What should we call this day? Let's call it Dice. What are you guys doing for Dice this year? Have a merry Dice. Or maybe it might be better to say they called it chance or chances, as in what are the chances? What are the chances that things would turn out this way? What are the chances that Queen Vashti would refuse to obey King Xerxes? What are the chances that a cute Jewish girl would take her place? What are the chances that her cousin would overhear a plot to assassinate the king? What are the chances that the king would not be able to sleep the very night the enemy was building his gallows? What are the chances that the king would have this part of his history books read to him that very night? What are the chances that on March 7th, 473 BC, that the Jews, would win? Or what if there's no such thing as chance? What if there's only such a thing as providence? The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. What if there's a sovereign ruler over all things who has an inscrutable but unimprovable plan for all things? And what if we are living under his reign? This book famously never says his name. But that just makes you feel it all the more, doesn't it? It's kind of like if I say, okay, now, don't think about a pink elephant. What hopped into your mind just right now? Some of you, you can keep from doing it because you've got strong wills, I know. But the rest of you immediately thought about what I just told you don't think about. Don't think about a pink elephant. Don't think about God when reading Esther. He's not in there. Oh no. He's everywhere in there. He may be hidden, but he's reigning. Somebody was turning the events, and we know his name. And we know that he's reigning over our lives today. We don't live in a random world. We aren't at the mercy of chance. We don't live in a meaningless world without a God who is turning the events one by one in an incomprehensible way for our good and for his glory. We see chaos. We see senseless violence. We see injustice. We can't always see his throne, but it's always there. And he's always there on it. And one day his kingdom will come in its fullness. It will be visible and uncontested and everlasting. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Our God reigns. He rules the world with truth and grace and makes the nations prove the glories of his righteousness and the wonders of his love. In verse 29, Queen Esther writes her own decree. This is wild. I never noticed this before. I don't know how many times I've read this book. I never noticed that Esther sends out her own decree along with Mordecai. It's also about Purim. Look at verse 29. So Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, along with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter concerning Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews in the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Xerxes, words of goodwill and assurance. Sounds like tidings of comfort and joy to me, right? To establish these days of Purim at their designated times, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had decreed for them, and as they had established for themselves and their descendants in regard to their times of fasting and lamentation. Esther's decree confirmed these regulations about Purim, and it was written down in the records. And church, that's the last time Esther's mentioned in her book or in the Bible. The last thing we hear from her is that she, as queen, wants her kinsmen to remember what happened to them forever. Days of feasting and joy, year after year after year. It says in verse 31 that they had days of fasting as well. And the Jews do that today too. They fast for 3 days, like Esther did before Purim. And then they read the scriptures about the Amalekites and Agag and all of that leading up to the tale of Queen Esther. And then they read and reenact her story once more. And here we are listening to it today. What a woman Esther was. What a great lady. What courage, what bravery, what wisdom, what love for her people. Take a bow, Queen Esther. Well done, you. And Queen Esther's last thing that she leaves them with is not just their rescue, but the command to remember their rescue. To not forget it. To not take it lightly. To mark it. To record it. To remember it. To revel in it. To rejoice. They were saved. It's easy to forget that we're saved. It's easy to lose sight of our salvation and to increasingly feel sorry for ourselves. Do you feel sorry for yourself sometime this week? We can begin to ask again, where is God? And need reminding. That's why we need reminded. That's why we come together on Sundays. That's why we set up mile markers and landmarks. Baptism and the Lord's Supper. And that's why we have big holidays, special days, days like Christmas where we take a break and remember what God has done. When the kids dress up as Mary and Joseph and the angels and the shepherds. When we sing songs and eat great food and drink eggnog and give gifts to each other and to the poor. Days of feasting and joy. Last chapter, chapter 10. It's only three verses. We're almost there. Let's do something new now as we read this, like the Jews do. Let's cheer every time I read the name Mordecai, okay? Give it a yay or a whoop whoop, something like that, okay? There's two of them here. Chapter 10, verse 1. King Xerxes imposed tribute throughout the empire to its distant shores. All his acts of power and might, together with a full account of the greatness of Mordecai, to which the king had raised him, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Media and Persia? Mordecai, the Jew, was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the shalom, the welfare of all of the Jews. Now, I know these three verses are supposed to be encouraging, and they are, as they talk about the happy ending for Mordecai. It's a comedy. He's come so far. He's even mentioned in the history books that survived to this day. And Mordecai was a good man and did good by his people. Take a bow, Mordecai. Well done, you. But this time reading it this week, I was really struck by how Xerxes is still the king. And he hasn't really changed at all. Xerxes is still not a good man. The best thing that can be said for him here is that he raised up Mordecai. Good for him. Well done, you. But verse 1 says he imposed a tribute. That's another tax. Probably to raise money to go fight the Greeks again. Maybe to pay for all the damage that Haman did, that he let Haman did. I know, let's have the kingdom pay for it. But Xerxes is pretty much back to normal. He's just doing Xerxes kinds of things. There's no record that he really changed, even though the Lord used him to rescue his people. The secular history books don't mention Esther. And a few years later, Xerxes let his guard down again, and he was assassinated in his bed. He didn't convert. As far as we know, he didn't come to worship the God of his queen. We end the book with a sense that, as great as so many things turned out, there's still something important missing. And that is the perfect king. You and I know that the perfect king was still on the way. And because of the wisdom of Mordecai and the courage of Esther, and over it all, the providential reign of God, that king would come. The bloodline of the Messiah was saved on Adar 13, 473 BC, so that Jesus Christ could one day be born and bring the greatest reversal, the greatest relief, and the greatest rest ever imagined, and so that we can have days of feasting and joy forevermore. Amen? Amen.